futuro.
Hey family, what's up, what's up, what's up? Welcome to In The Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, and it's Friday, and it's ITT Sound Off, and Maria Hinojosa is recording from
Punta Cana,
one of my favorite islands in the world, from Dominican Republic.
Last Friday recording of the year, and I'm in the Dominican Republic, and you're in your basement, and it's the end of 2021-ish. And, you know, and shit is still real, right? I mean, I know everybody is feeling this. We're all feeling again.
Yes.
We recognize it here on In The Thick. Not to say that we're able to resolve it, but this is a place where at least we can talk about stuff because it just keeps on coming. So our first topic is police violence. On Wednesday, Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd, pleaded guilty to violating Floyd's civil rights, which is actually, as you know, a federal charge. Now, it's the first time that he has admitted that he kept his knee on Floyd's neck after he was no longer responsive, which resulted in Floyd's death.
Hmm.
And earlier this year, Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of George Floyd. With this new charge and his guilty plea, he's going to probably face some more time in prison. At the same time, we're seeing the ongoing trial for Kim Potter. This is the former police officer from Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, who shot and killed 20 years old, okay? Dante Wright, during a traffic stop this past April.
Yeah.
So during the trial, a use of force expert testified on Wednesday that it was not appropriate for Potter to have used deadly force against Wright, which Potter's defense is arguing was justified, ... during a traffic stop. I'm just going to underline that again. On Wednesday, Dante's father, Aubrey Wright, testified about his son and their life together. Let's take a listen.
I tried to let him understand the difference between where at work I'm your boss and at home I'm your dad. It's the difference. So, but it was funny. Like, it was this one time, where I had sent him home because he was on his phone at work and he wasn't supposed to be on the phone anywhere again. I was like, yo, we gotta go home. And so he went and asked my boss, is it okay if my dad sends me home? And I'm like, my boss like, yeah, he's your boss. And I'm like, well, you need to go home and come out in the hallway, and he's still there. And I'm like, well, why are you still here? And he's like, well, Dad, I rode with you. I couldn't go home because you're my ride. I think it's funny, but yeah, that was a funny thing that happened at work.
So not only were you working together, but you were driving to and from
work
together?
Every day, yeah.
You got to spend some quality time together?
Yeah, spend a lot of time together.
These moments are really important because, you know, Dante was a 20-year-old who had this relationship with his dad. Yeah, he had a life.
Exactly, with a life. And I'm glad we shared that clip, you know, because I think it was so important to humanize Dante. I think about the times when, you know, my son Miguel, who's like 19, I would drive him to school, I would drive him to soccer, we'd have these long like rides to his, you know, when he'd take him to his games, right? And I can just sense, just hearing Mr. Wright talking about his son, like, this is my life. This is my kid.
Mm.
He was part of me. And
he should be alive.
He should still be working with me. I should still be driving with him every day. That's the part that just,
Dante was a father himself.
Right.
And I'm glad that we brought this up. I think everybody, again, this, you know, guilty plea from Chauvin is just like, why? What is this about?
You know what's interesting about that now that he was sentenced? The fact that
it just makes the whole trial just like, don't tell me that you so-called got religion after the trial where you were like, oh shit, like they were right. No. So it's very, again, in the United States, just very confusing about it all because it's not three steps forward. It's just even more confusing because both George Floyd and Dante Wright should be alive at the end of the year 2021 and should be with their families. And this is the legacy of the United States of America.
That's the takeaway for me in all this. And whatever happens in the Potter case, and I believe Potter's going to testify. So is it going to be like a Kyle Rittenhouse strategy here that you bring the white police officer now because it works so well with the Rittenhouse trial to be like, I was afraid of my life. I was, you know, that's the part where I think when you become effective,
works,
right? When the Rittenhouse defense used it, worked, then now you're going to have someone like Potter very likely going to do the same thing.
I was just going to say.
And will she cry? right?
And oh my gosh.
It's a white woman crying, you know, is that going to happen? That's the part where, you know, white supremacy as sympathy becomes an issue.
And also white women and their fragility because of, oh my God, it's a black man. It's like,
yeah, yeah.
Hello, do you remember Emmett Till? Just can we, again, just open our eyes to the real history of this country. Coño, have a little bit of consciousness, por favor.
Okay, so let's move on to our second topic, which is about the January 6th investigation. On Monday, the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol voted to hold former Trump White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, in criminal contempt for defying their subpoena and is recommending the Justice Department move forward with criminal charges. Then on Tuesday, the House voted to fine Meadows in criminal contempt. And this comes days after Meadows didn't show up for his deposition. Meadows has sued the committee and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi because why not, right? That's what you're supposed to do in America. You're just supposed to say, oh, you can't, I'm going to sue you, right? And is asking the court to invalidate his subpoenas. And this is the bullshit. Meadows' lawyer is claiming executive privilege under Trump. But before he stopped cooperating, Meadows turned over thousands of documents, which revealed all these text messages from Trump's own son, members of Congress, and Fox News hosts urging Trump to speak out against the Capitol violence.
Okay.
Okay. And remember, a lot of these hosts were the same people who were downplaying the violence of the day.
And who loved Trump 100%, no matter what, would never cross him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My goal in the thick right now is to always feature Ellie Mistel. Because, you know, he's my new favorite guest. He's my new buddy. He was on In the Thick earlier this year. Great show. But on Tuesday, Ellie, who's the justice correspondent for The Nation, went on another friend of the show, Joy Ann Reid, on MSNBC, talking about the dynamics of Fox News. So here's Ellie. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, look, the Fox hosts are lying liars who lie. That's what they do. And they lied about this. They've lied about other things. And when you haul them into court, and sue them for defamation about their lies, they will say in court, no reasonable person takes my show seriously. That was the Tucker Carlson literal legal argument. No yes. reasonable person takes my show seriously. And so, and that worked, by the way. That was a fine legal argument. It got him out of some legal hot water. So we know what they are. They know what they are. Like, everybody is in on the joke except for the gullible white supremacist viewers of Fox News.
What are your thoughts? I mean, lying liars who lie.
You know, I just wish that we could see it as some kind of show. You know, it's been a long time since I've watched Fox News because I'm not in hotels. That's where I would tend to watch Fox News. But anyway, the point is that if it weren't so serious, if it weren't such a detriment and such hypocrisy. I mean, you know, I always say this. I worked with Tucker Carlson at CNN.
I was at the Republican National Convention and he came up to you. He gave you a hug. It was surreal when I saw him come up to you.
So this is, you know, as we think about what white America is capable of doing unto itself because of its lack of coño, compassion, they will do this. They will be complete hypocrites and get paid for it. And don't get me started on Lara Logan, you know, and all of the other. I mean, there are people who are flocking to Fox News to be on the air there, former journalists of other places. And meanwhile, there are people who are leaving Fox News, right, to go to other networks, which is dangerous and scary, too. The point is the hypocrisy. And what we do here is transparency. And it's kind of like the essence of journalism. It's either one or the other. It's either complete hypocrisy or it's complete transparency. And we're seeing, and oh, it's just so damaging.
You know, I was at the Capitol this week.
Yes, you were there. You were kind of sending me these texts just like, whoa, it's crazy to be here.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I wanted to see what Futuro, you know, the coverage we're doing with the Build Back Better and immigration and just kind of be there, right, with a press pass.
Our coverage has been great. The Build Back Better bill, not so great at all.
Yeah, exactly. So I followed. I literally went back like I was one of those like reporter, like DC reporter, like going through the Capitol. And it was actually a really good experience.
You retraced the steps. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. So I went back and went to some of the areas. First of all, when you go outside now, I saw armed guards with automatic rifles like in the back of the steps, like two or three manning sort of the entrances. You know, the steps of the Capitol, which was pretty
Land of the free. No, yeah. This is the way, you know, in Mexican national, Palacio Nacional, siempre you would see, you know, soldiers and now, but not in the United States.
But you're saying a little bit more of a presence, but I did go through some of the spaces where the insurrectionists, the rioters, the coup supporters like went through. And I have to say, being in the presence of this building is so awe-inspiring. It reminds you so much of this is the American ideal. You know, whatever we know about the imperfections of the American experience and what we were just talking about, like, you know, white supremacy, like that is America. But like being there in the moment, thinking about what happened in January 6th earlier this year and being there later and not coming to terms with it yet. That's what it is, Maria, because when you see the senators, they're coming off the tunnels and they're going to go to votes. All the Democratic senators are masked. All the Democratic aides are masked. And all the Republican senators have no masks in their aides. So you can literally see the partisan divide just by people who are masked or not. That was just something that really, you know what? It just etched in a memory in me. And Republicans, as much as all these texts are happening and all these other things and Mark Meadows and everything is this and all that and Fox News, I don't necessarily think anything's going to come out of this. And that's the part that really, really upsets me.
Our final topic brings us back to Congress and hypocrisy as well. So the House approved a bill on Tuesday to combat Islamophobia globally. It's very interesting. Mm. This comes just weeks after Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert's anti-Muslim comments towards Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, where she insinuated that Ilhan Omar, a member of Congress, is a terrorist.
Yeah.
Coño. The legislation titled the Combating International Islamophobia Act is co-sponsored by Representative Omar, along with Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois. And it requires the State Department to create a special envoy for monitoring and combating Islamophobia. Now, during the debate of the bill, Republican Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania implied that Representative Omar has ties to terrorist organizations and is anti-Semitic. O sea, putting it in the record.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Which is some bullshit. So we're watching this anti-Muslim rhetoric in Congress, in the halls of Congress. And at the same time, we're seeing these anti-Muslim tactics inside the very organizations that are supposed to be helping Muslim communities.
Yeah.
This is not surprising. This, what I'm about to say, is not surprising. I have been covering the Muslim community since the early 1990s.
Yep.
So the fact that it was revealed on Tuesday that the Ohio chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations, known as CAIR, C-A-I-R, fired its executive leader and director, Roman Iqbal, after an investigation found that he was actually recording the organization's meetings.
Wow.
And passing on confidential information to an anti-Muslim hate group for years. So, you know, it's the infiltration, the way in which there's a way of disreputing organizations that are committed to civil rights. This is a big blow. And for many people, you know, again, they're just going to be like, well, this is so confusing. You know, like, I'm really like, what? It's like, it's not confusing. Muslim people are your neighbors. They are my students.
Yeah.
They are our colleagues. They are your bosses.
They are in the thick guests and all stars.
They are intellectuals. They are writers. Hello, Waj. They, in other words, that actually they are everywhere amongst us. And the sooner that we realize this is the first thing that we need to do to protect each other, right? Is to see ourselves in each other. So, yeah, don't be confused because the Muslim people have been here since forever and in our country. So please don't make this seem like something, oh, I'm so confused and, oh, but, you know. No, no, no. Listen to what is happening now. It was anti-Semitic actions, you know, in the 1940s, 30s, 50s, right? That people would just kind of say these things. It's anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim statements that are said all the time. Now it has to stop because it's leading to violence.
Right. And speaking of, you mentioned Wajahat Ali, who is obviously an OG in the thick all-star, but we've been talking about it. And one of the things he told me in a thing that we recorded, it's going to come out next week, is that imagine if Ilhan Omar questioned the Christianity of, you know, Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene or everyone and went in and be like, she's a Christian terrorist. Imagine if it was turned. Mm-hmm. Like the reaction that we would have seen not only in the Congress, but in this country where that's what I think that's the point, right? It's like the Muslims have been part of this country forever. There were foundations of, you know, Islamophobia before 9/11, but it's obvious that, you know, what the Republican Party has decided to do moving forward is that Islamophobia is part of their party platform. And, you know, critics be damned. And there's enough support in the United States that it becomes a political issue that people run on.
Look, the thing is that the United States has had anti-Muslim laws. They are an excluded group. They have been attacked. So when this country suddenly says, oh my God, anti-Muslim violence, what a surprise. It's in the laws. Just like anti-Asian hate, exactly. It has been in the laws. So it is good that we have at least a legal response to Islamophobia. It's a tiny but important step forward. So we're going to take a moment to recognize the trailblazing, incredible work of bell hooks, a born Gloria Jean Watkins, author, cultural critic, poet, feminist scholar, icon, Black empowered woman. She passed away on Wednesday at the age of 69. So really gone way too soon. She wrote so many books. And for me, when I first encountered bell hooks, it's very interesting because, you know, I was a women's studies major at Barnard College, a women's college. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was really through feminism that I encounter bell hooks. But what ends up happening is that it's really about her Black womanhood as well as love. She was all about using love to combat the patriarchy.
Yeah.
And I just remember reading her, and we were also in dark times, I guess, in the 1980s when I was reading her intensely. And it was so important because it gave us hope. We have seen so many remembrances of her from across generationally in the country. So here we want to replay a clip from a 1999 interview with bell hooks. Enjoy listening to the voice and thoughts of bell hooks.
What do we teach our children about love? What is the miseducation we give them? And part of the miseducation we give them is that you can violate someone and then say you love them. And I think as we ponder why we are raising a nation of violent children, we have to ponder that miseducation about the nature of love. Which doesn't mean to say that I'm not saying in the discipline is important, because discipline is crucial to any true love. That we have boundaries, that we set boundaries. So I think part of what's happened to us as a nation is we have confused discipline with a kind of blind obedience to authoritarianism, whether it's children to parents or us to a government or a nation that is acting in a way that is autocratic and wrong. So that the book doesn't just try to look at our personal relationship to love, but what's happening to us as a nation as we move away from the kind of ethic of love that many of us felt undergirded all the great social movements, movements for social justice.
And, you know, love, just as a political concept, you know, when we deal with so much hatred and white supremacy and patriarchy.
Yeah.
And that's why for bell hooks and for all of us, you know, love as a revolutionary tool. And I know that it means a lot even to people right here, very close to In the Thick, right?
Yeah, very, very close to In the Thick. Our lead producer, Noor Sali.
Our fearless leader.
Fearless leader. Staten Island in the house. Just shared this tweet this week after bell hooks passed away. And I'm just going to read it to close out the show. And it's like, bell hooks taught us about radical love. Love is resistance to domination. Love is liberation. Love is a political tool. Love is a philosophy. May we all carry that focus into the next year. I mean, that's basically the In the Thick editorial mantra that we're going to use into 2022. Thank you, Noor, for keeping us focused. And we love you a lot.
And it's weird, right? Because we're like hardcore political, you know, we use these big bad words and
you're angry Mexican lady. I'm angry Puerto Rican man. I know, but love's in the house.
Anyway, you got to give some love to get some love. Let's just go ahead and take that for this Friday's edition of In the Thick. We'll do that. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Preaching love. Remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us and show us some.
Show us some love.
What a segue. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know and love to listen to In the Thick. Hello, but I'm bummed. In the Thick is produced with love by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, Lisa Salinas, and our fellow Sarah Hershander, with editorial support from Mike Sargent. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julie Caruso, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me the entire year. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode. We'll be there, so you better be there, all right? Time off means more time to listen to In the Thick, because we family. Love ya. Bye.
Bye, y'all.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.